We will, that this panel of the Court of Appeals is now ready for the third case on today's oral argument calendar. That is case number A20-1598, Dominic Jerome Sublette, and counsel may correct my pronunciation if you wish, versus Lori Catherine Schultz. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and then proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Elizabeth Bentley for appellant Lori Catherine Schultz. In denying Ms. Schultz's motion to modify custody of her five children, the district court legally erred when it disregarded substantial evidence showing that continuing the operative custody order in which respondent Mr. Sublette shares custody of the children would endanger the children's physical or emotional well-being. Specifically, the court set aside evidence that Mr. Sublette engaged in acts of physical violence against Ms. Schultz in front of the children, that in a separate incident, he had kicked and hit one child, resulting in an order for protection for that child that was in place throughout the entirety of these district court modification proceedings, as well as evidence that all the children exhibited severe negative emotional responses to seeing or spending parenting time with Mr. Sublette. The court held as a legal matter that Ms. Schultz could not establish endangerment in the present environment simply because this and other evidence of Mr. Schultz's conduct was more than a year old. That bright line rule conflicts.
If I can ask a clarifying question, Ms. Bentley, yep. When you say more than a year old, that it appears that the district court applied sort of a look back period and that it start or ended, I guess, the look back period from the date of the hearing. Am I correct that A, the district court had this informal look back period, and also that it looked backwards from the hearing date, not the date of the motion?
That's correct. That's how I read the decision. The court held that she hadn't established that the evidence, I believe the evidence of 1 year old at the time of the hearing is what the court says at addendum page 8 in paragraph 32. So the look back period was from the date of the January 2020 hearing, not the date when she first filed the motion. But in doing so and creating that bright line rule, it conflicted with this court's well-established precedent that the present environment is the last judicially created environment, meaning the environment where both parents shared custody 50-50%. And it also disregarded that this court has held that the evidence of a parent's history of care is relevant to what can be expected if they were to continue to parent under that same arrangement today.
Can I ask you about the history of care? I'm a little, it seems like you characterize in your briefs that consideration of the history of care is a requirement. And when I read Hassing, I mean, it talks about the history of care being a relevant consideration. And I don't disagree with you that it might be an abuse of discretion for the district court not to address the history of care at all when evidence is presented on that subject. But my question is, what is the legal basis for the claim that a district court must consider the history of care in arriving at its decision?
Sure. And I'm glad, Judge Frisch, that you raised the Hassing case, because I think that that's really where this comes through most clearly, where the court said there are kind of three points that decision makes. The first is you can't solely decide on history of care. You have to look at whether a history of care or if there is a history of endangerment, that it continues to pose a danger today. But so you can't look solely at care. But then in the next paragraph, or it says that history of care is a relevant consideration. And that's because it must be, because it is indicative of what can be expected what can be presently expected. So to the extent that there is evidence of history of care at issue, which it certainly is in this case, that evidence is a relevant consideration to what can be expected. So a district court.
So just to read the entirety of the sentence in Hassing, it reads, the history of a child's care is a relevant consideration in addressing the child's current circumstances, which is, I don't know. I mean, I haven't, I don't know if that's present circumstances or current circumstances. I am not sure if there's a distinction there.
Well, the court, what's, and I think that the district court here in its analysis wasn't extremely precise as to how it was talking about present environment. So there are a couple of issues at play here. The first is that the court's precedent is very clear in Taflin, in Wendt v. Wendt, in numerous cases cited in our briefs, that present environment means the current operative custody order, right? There's a number of instances where the factual living environment is different from the from what the operative order says. So, but certainly, you know, Hassing does say, and we don't dispute at all, that the current factual circumstances could be, in fact, probably are relevant, or the court should consider those. But the point, as I read Hassing, is you can't look at evidence of past history of abuse at the exclusion of recent evidence, but you also can't look at recent evidence at the exclusion of relevant history of care, which is a relevant consideration as to whether or not the child continues to be endangered today. And the court in Hassing reversed the district court's decision precisely, and this is right at the change to 703, page 703 to 704, because the court did nothing to, or nothing in the record had showed that the court even attempted to determine whether that history of care poses a continuing danger today. And that's precisely
Would you characterize that as an abuse of discretion by the district court for failing to consider the evidence that was presented to it? Or would you describe that as an error of law?
Certainly the way that I read that and the way that we've briefed this case is that it's an error of law as having not applied the correct standard. It, you know, as I read the decision, it drew a bright line saying there was no evidence of recent conduct of his parenting. Of course, there was evidence in the record of recent evidence of the children's well-being, their emotional improvements, their improvements in school, and other evidence. But there was no recent evidence of his parenting, you know, more than a year old. So as I read that, I see that as an error of law. You know, certainly to the extent that you think that the court articulated the right standard or was technically applying the correct legal standard, then, you know, you could view this as an abuse of discretion as well. I don't see, either way, I see the outcome as being the same, that the court erred here and that it refused to consider substantial relevant evidence.
I understand, Ms. Bentley, that the two youngest children did not testify, that your client did not call them to testify. Did she attempt in other ways to put in evidence of their experiences while at father's household, whether through secondhand testimony or other means? I guess I'm wondering whether the district court statement of no evidence is accurate.
She certainly did put in evidence of their recent both of their experiences prior to and after and immediately, or I should say prior to her filing the motion, as well as in the time period prior to the hearing. For example, there's evidence in the record that the youngest children were witness to the domestic violence incident from 2016, where Mr. Sublett had slammed Ms. Schultz's foot in the door. All the children were present and witnessed that event. And that a substantial amount of evidence in the record as to the emotional distress that they had experienced in going and spending parenting time with Mr. Sublett. And to be clear, emotional distress in Minnesota under this court's decision in Lillibo, Ross v. Ross, Harkema v. Harkema, and the statute itself clearly recognize that emotional distress and fear can form the basis of an endangerment finding. The two youngest children, there's testimony in the record that they always cried, complained on the day that they had to go to spend parenting time with Mr. Sublett. The second youngest child, SS, who was 7 to 8 years old at the time, would send distressing messages to her mom when she was at his home before going to parenting time, would lock herself in the bathroom for upwards of 6 to 7 hours to avoid that parenting time. And that the youngest child, age AS, who was age 5 to 6 at the time, would try to run away from home on his bike prior to going to spending parenting time with him. Moreover, the two oldest children, LS and BS, who were ages 14 and 16 at the time of the hearing, both testified to the extent of the their younger siblings' distress at going to spending parenting time with their father. Ms. Schultz also presented a more recent evidence of improvements that they've experienced since coming into her care full time. And the court's decision in Ross v. Ross has recognized that improvements to emotional distress or school performance can be indicative of a finding of endangerment in the operative order. The kids have all had huge improvements emotionally and mentally. This is an addendum. The court made findings even to this 6 to 7. AS, the youngest child, his reading ability has tripled. SS has become a reading mentor as compared to needing reading help. These are, again, at addendum pages 6 to 7.
So it sounds like, and if I may interrupt, it sounds like there is perhaps a lack of evidence of what occurred inside his house, because some of those things, such as the daughter crying in the bathroom, occurred at mother's house and so on. But perhaps you're asking us, or you asked the district court to make inferences, perhaps from these consequences to infer backward that they must be caused by parenting that is endangerment. Am I summarizing accurately?
That's right. And that's similar to what this court did in the case Ross v. Ross, where it found endangerment based in part on the fact that the children had suffered emotional distress, which had resulted in school performance problems that would be alleviated by a change of custody. So here we have a direct example or evidence that by changing the living environment of the children, that a lot of their emotional and school performance issues have been alleviated. So certainly the district court should have done that. The way that I read the district court's decision is that it looked at and, you know, it credited all of this evidence, but it said that because she hadn't shown evidence of his direct parenting or his parenting environment within the year preceding the hearing, she couldn't meet her burden. This is a point I want to make really clear here, that with respect to 3 of the 5 children subject to this decision, they were already in her care full time at the time that she filed the motion and at the time she filed the motion and beyond. With respect to OS, the 3rd child, there was still an order for protection in place at the time throughout the entire proceedings. There is no way that she could have shown evidence of his actual parenting in the time preceding the hearing because there was a court order preventing him from seeing the child outside of a counseling setting. Same with BS, the 2nd oldest child. He had refused parenting contact since 2016, and Mr. Sublett had not made any effort to reestablish parenting time. And that was because of his experience intervening in the domestic violence incident in 2016. There was no opportunity for Mr. Sublett already to have established, for Ms. Schultz to have shown any evidence of his actual parenting. And LS had chosen ever since the beginning of this never to have contact with her father. So with respect to the 2 youngest kids, there's ample evidence showing that that they as well would be endangered continuing in the current environment. And the court below just simply disregarded all of that context in light of its bright line rule.
Ms. Bentley, getting back to the meaning of present, and I understand your argument being that the present circumstances require you to start with the last operative order. What's the longest amount of time that you have seen in your review of the cases between the operative order and the motion, or what's the most expansive? Because in this case, if you look at the allegations, you have some in right after the stipulation in 2016. You also have a finding of domestic violence in 2018, and then the motion being brought in July of 2019. So we have not much time passing from the 2018 to the 2019 motion, more time going back to 2016. So I guess the question is, what have you seen as we apply the meaning that you want us to for what present circumstances mean, looking back to the last operative order? Have you found cases where that amount of time is greater than 3 years, for example?
Yes, and I'm trying to pull precise examples. I mean, I've certainly seen cases, I believe in the case Taflin v. Taflin, there was evidence going back to, if I'm, so the decision was in 85, if I'm remembering, at least to 91 or 81, excuse me. Certainly there are cases where you go back 2 to 3 years. In the case, Bjork versus Wilcox, there was evidence going back, I believe, about approximately 2 to 3 years prior to the court's decision that looked at the, so in Bjork versus Wilcox, the mom had been granted custody, but the children had been living with their grandparents for, I believe, about 2 years before the court's hearing. And the court considered evidence certainly greater than 1 year old, if not 2 to 3 years old, with respect to the prior, whether or not the children would be endangered in the mom's care, given her living environment, prior mental health history. And I think point you to Taflin v. Taflin. The point here, I mean, either way, what is clear is that, and I see that I'm out of time, but if I just would finish the point really quickly, the statute certainly doesn't draw any kind of temporal limitation. And to the extent that, you know, there's evidence 5, 6 years old, I certainly could see where that could be less relevant than maybe more recent evidence. And that is all within the district court's consideration or discretion in weighing the evidence. But there's no reason to draw any kind of bright timeline rule. And in fact, it makes no sense in common sense as to how these circumstances tend to unravel. You want to be able to allow district courts to look at the totality of the evidence instead of turning a blind eye to evidence that's extremely relevant and yet is otherwise completely disregarded. So with that, I see that I'm out of time. I'm happy to address other issues on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bentley. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Good morning. Jonathan Reppy for Dominic Sublett, the respondent. The district court properly applied the legal standard of Minnesota statute 518.18D in this matter. A review of the findings of fact indicate that the district court, with specificity and detail, reviewed the appellant's evidence in this case, her witness testimony, and the testimony of herself. The district court did not create a new legal standard. The district court's finding of fact and conclusion of law properly identify that it was appellant's burden to show that the children were endangered in their present environment. The appellant would have you, or the appellant has cherry-picked certain times that put her in the most favorable light in this case.
Mr. Reppy, can I just ask you a question about the conclusions of law that the district court found? I'm looking on page 10 of your addendum, paragraph 4 of the conclusions of law. And there's a legal standard, or it appears that the district court is applying a legal standard that mom failed to meet her burden of proof that the children were endangered in father's care at the time of the evidentiary hearing. What is the legal basis for the application of that standard? Because I did not see, I mean, it's not, there's none cited in the order.
I would point the court to Hassing. Frankly, there is no temporal limitation on what the court can look at. There is also no limitation on the emphasis that the district court can place on certain timelines. There's been no court decision that says a district court must look at a certain period of time and favor that more than another period of time. If you look at the various decisions, particularly in Hassing, I would point you to Hassing and say that it's just not the judicially determined time, but a variety of time.
So my question is, the district court did credit the testimony describing 2 incidents after the order, one in November of 2016 and one in, I think it's October of 2018. And then the district court seemed to not consider those incidents in determining endangerment simply because of the temporal disconnect between the time of the hearing and the time of the incidents. What's the legal basis for doing that when Hassing itself says that the concept of present environment is a reference to the last judicially created environment?
Yeah, Hassing also says that it's not the exclusive determination. And I would argue that despite the fact that the district court didn't necessarily cite those incidents as a determination of their conclusion, by demonstrating that they took consideration of those incidents, they didn't ignore them, Your Honor. Specifically, I think if you look at the procedural history, that indicates that the district court did not ignore that.
So, Mr. Reppe, what was the purpose of the district court saying 1 year from the time of the hearing, if the district court didn't actually follow that on its own standard?
Well, I think the district court emphasized the 1 year prior to the hearing more than it emphasized the previous history. I agree with that analysis. The district court certainly emphasized that more. But there's nothing that indicates they're not allowed to emphasize that.
You would agree that that's not what the district court said in its conclusion of law, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, I would agree with that.
So you're now, I guess, looking at the rest of the order to say that the district court actually did consider something that, pursuant to its own conclusion of law, it was not going to consider.
No, what I'm saying is that the district court weighed the testimony, weighed the evidence, and put more emphasis on the last year of the history, the present environment, than it did in the previous history.
Right. And I understand you're not arguing that we should adopt a bright line 1 year look back rule.
Okay. Absolutely correct. Yeah. There is no guidance, however, for the district on how to weigh the various timelines. You can look at the history of care, and if you look at the findings of fact in this case, the court certainly looked at the history of care in this matter. They'd had the opportunity to disallow testimony, but the testimony was allowed from the three older children in particular about incidents and the environment prior to 2016. So the court obviously looked at the history of care when they allowed that testimony. There was testimony from the grandmother in this case, the maternal grandmother in this case, again, prior to the previous stipulation in 2016. And even though the appellant argues that the timeline between the filing of her motion in July of 2019 and the eventual hearings in January of 2020 and June of 2020 should not be looked at, they certainly presented evidence between those timelines. Counsel just identified testimony and evidence regarding the children's education, their improvement in school. The appellant wants it both ways here when you look at time.
Let me kind of take this in a different way. So the district court is imposing this, it seems to be imposing some sort of a relevant time period for consideration for behaviors that might endanger the children. And I don't really understand why it is the district court applied the look back period starting from the date of the hearing, as opposed to the date that mom filed the motion. Because mom doesn't have any control over when the hearing is set. She has all the control as to when she files the motion. And there is one domestic incident that occurred in the 1 year preceding the filing of the motion. So why is it that even under the standard that the district court seems to have adopted here, it didn't even follow its own standard as it's stated in its conclusions?
Let me see if I get this right.
It's a little confusing.
Yeah, the argument is that Due to the delay in the hearing between July and January and then June, that the court should have looked at the time prior to the filing of the motion, that they shouldn't have allowed any evidence post July.
No, that's not really what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the district court is saying, I'm going to look back a year to see if there are any recent incidents of endangerment that I need to look at. And so that year, according to the district court, starts at the time of the hearing as opposed to the time of the filing of the motion. So mm-hmm. when mom files her motion, if we're going to look back a year, there's a domestic incident. But if we wait 6 months until there's a hearing and then we apply this 1 year look back period, all of a sudden the domestic incident is outside of the look back period. So when mom doesn't have any control as to when the hearing is set, I'm not quite sure why the district court is doing that or what the basis is for doing that, or even if it followed its own standard as it stated in its conclusions.
Yeah, I agree that looking at the standard in that manner, there presents an opportunity for manipulation because a person could file a motion, the hearing's delayed for whatever matter, and the opposing party can then be on good behavior until that time to manipulate the time or purposefully delay the hearing in order to present a history that's more favorable to them. I agree. What I disagree is that I don't necessarily believe that the district court created a standard of 1 year look back period exclusively. And what I'm saying about that is that they certainly cited that recent means 1 year, all right? But they certainly took the history of care into account, which is demonstrated by the detailed findings of fact concerning appellant's witnesses and testimony. One of the factors that I would indicate here is that the appellant also had some opportunity to manipulate the matter because prior to her motion in July, she arbitrarily stopped parenting time with the children. The appellant would have you believe that it was due to the OFP, but the youngest children did not.
Right, but Mr. Reppy, let me interrupt because at that point in time, if your client was concerned about this, as you put it, arbitrary decision, he's free to make a motion for parenting time assistance and doesn't do so. I'd like to move back to the question that was asked and draw you back to that, because it sounds like you're asking us to make some determination that to infer or to imply a conclusion of law that the court applied that's contrary to what its own conclusion of law says. And if that is the case, I'm wondering what is the authority for this court to infer or imply a legal standard that is contrary to the one noted in the district court's own opinion.
Well, I'll be frank, there is no legal standard that provides that there's only a 1 year look back period. That there clearly is no legal standard that says to the district court that the only period of time that they can review is 1 year prior to the hearing.
Is the legal standard that says that in the district court's order, is that by itself enough for this court to question the outcome and assume that the district court is following its own legal standard? Or it sounds like your argument is that we should disregard the statement of law that the district court provided and instead infer that the district court was applying a different legal standard and affirm.
I would argue that the district court balanced the evidence and emphasize the last year greater than the other time. But the findings of fact indicate that they heard the evidence and weighed it. The conclusion of law doesn't say that they ignored the previous testimony. The conclusions of law doesn't state that they ignored the history of care. If that were the case, they could have disallowed the testimony respondent at trial asked for a directed verdict upon the end of appellant's case. The court denied the directed verdict at that point and scheduled an additional hearing where respondent testified and two other witnesses testified. The fact that that occurred indicates to me that the court weighed that testimony and found it more compelling than appellant's testimony.
Mr. Ruppe, my question is, you're arguing that it's not legal error for the district court to incorrectly state the law, to state the wrong legal standard because it applied the correct legal standard. And my question is, what authority is there for this court to look to that we can, in our review, conclude that the district court did not make an error of law despite its incorrect legal standard because, in our view, it applied the correct one, maybe accidentally or unwittingly? What's the support for us to reach the conclusion you want us to reach if your argument is, in fact, that the district court misstated the law but actually applied the right standard?
I've only got a couple seconds, but I'll try to answer that quickly, Your Honor.
You can take more if you wish.
Okay. All right. The district court, in its conclusion of law, said that the appellant failed to meet their burden. All right. That is the correct standard. They failed to meet their burden to demonstrate that the current or present environment created an endangerment for the children. That is the correct standard. The analysis, the conclusion of law stating that they looked back and over a year or simply a year and put more weight on that is not, there's no legal precedent for that. I would acknowledge that.
I have one more question, if I may. So in Hossing, we said the history of a child's care is a relevant consideration in addressing the child's current circumstances. And in that case, we said that there's no indication that the district court considered it. In this case, is it your position that the district court did consider the evidence of the history of care from several years earlier and actually factored it in, or that the district court, to use my own words, considering it and then decided that that it's not of any weight because it's too old? So I guess I've presented two different scenarios. If you understand them correctly, can you help me by saying how do you read the record? Did the district court do the first of those two things or the second?
I would argue that district court did the first of those two things. If the district court did not consider the history of care, why provide such a detailed analysis or fact of the appellant's testimony and their witness testimony? The item lacking here really is a detailed account in the findings of fact of the respondent's testimony and the respondent's witness testimony is really what's lacking here.
Thank you, Mr. Ruppe. It appears there are no further questions for you. Thank you for your arguments. Ms. Bentley, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. And if I may, to begin your rebuttal, I'm wondering, so I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument, that the 1 year period that we're talking about, am I correct that that's found in paragraph 32 of the district court's order and only there, or are there other statements in the district court's order referring to a 1 year period?
That's correct. That's addendum page 8 at paragraph 32, where it mentions the 1 year period. Of course, it also, and then the next page, addendum page 9, paragraph 33, it reiterates that she hasn't presented evidence connecting the children's behavior to any specific recent, and that's recent is italicized, conduct by father. So certainly there are a number of instances where the court focuses in on what it considers to be recent conduct. And as I read that paragraph on 32, it's focusing on 1 year is kind of what it's considering to be recent or present when it's making those emphases. But yes, to answer your question, that's my understanding of where it says that.
Ms. Bentley, it seems that there are other statements in what I'll refer to as the facts, right? Where the district court does two things. It lists what the testimony was. So-and-so testified that. And then there at the end of it, there's a one paragraph fact finding. And I would characterize that last paragraph under each of those as the findings of fact. And the rest of it is more reporting what somebody said, but not making an actual finding. And it seems that in many of those, the court is emphasizing present time, right? So for example, in paragraph 19, no firsthand knowledge of father's parenting since the custody order. And paragraph 22, may not reflect father in the best light. It does not present evidence that father's present parenting style. So it appears that this is a statement that is made throughout the district court's factual findings. And so I'm wondering if you're also, it's not confined to the one conclusion of law. It's also looking at the way that the district court made its factual conclusions.
Yeah, I just want to understand your question as to whether or not the court, are you talking specifically about this 1 year, whether they were considering it throughout their factual findings as well as the conclusion, or sorry, are you asking whether they're drawing a little bit more broadly on the time, kind of the time frame for each of these factual points?
I interpreted Judge Johnson's question as asking you to tell us kind of where it is in the order that you're challenging or asserting error. And my interpretation of your arguments is that it wasn't confined to an error in the conclusion of law, but at each time the district court is emphasizing present, we have to know what it is that they're doing. And I thought you were arguing that each time the district court talks about present, it's using that 1 year look back period.
Yes, sorry, thank you for the clarification. So that is how I read the decision. And I think what's important there is that the points that it's making throughout its factual findings do clarify that once you get, I mean, the actual legal analysis, which I see as on page, addendum page 10, paragraph 4, which is a three sentence paragraph, is the entirety of the court's legal analysis, as I read it, trying to apply the law. But in order to understand what it means when it says there have been no, quote, recent incidents giving rise to the conclusion that the children would be endangered in the father's care, quote, presently, that in order to understand that, it's clear from looking at those paragraphs that you've identified, and I think, you know, most clearly in paragraphs 32 and 33, addendum pages 8 and 9, to show us what the court meant by presently. And so that's certainly where we're drawing the legal conclusion about this 1 year, is that it's basically in its factual findings defining what it meant by one, by present or recent. So I hope that clarifies that question, if I've answered that sufficiently. But I want to just make two brief points, if I may, before my time is up. The first is, and this goes to one of your questions, Judge Bryan, is that we can look at what the district court said here and read it, take it for what it was. The court said that she didn't meet her burden because she relied on past behavior and there have been no recent incidents giving rise. That's the analysis. It drew a line. It said she didn't present recent evidence and she cannot establish her burden because of that. There's no way to read this decision as having weighed all of the evidence as respondent is arguing in order to come out having considered all of the history of care. And I think what's really critical here is that respondent points to the June hearing. The court made absolutely no findings on that. And what's important, there was a really critical fact that Ms. Schultz brought out during her cross-examination. So if I may finish my point, and I realize I'm out of time. On cross-examination of Mr. Sublett, he admitted that he, since the domestic violence incident with OS in 2018, that he, quote, did not attend domestic violence or counseling or any physical or personal therapy, or take any other actions to make changes. That's a really critical fact as to whether they continue to be in danger today. And Hassing itself, the facts there was evidence of improvement. And so the court said, hey, you have to go back and look at whether there's a continuing danger. So here there is evidence. The court didn't consider that at all. And that's at addendum page 9 in paragraph 36, where it said it wouldn't provide any analysis of the testimony from the June hearing. So to think that it did a holistic weighing of all of this evidence just doesn't reflect what the court said. And with that, I would ask this court to reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings, asking the court to apply the correct legal standard and assess whether or not the past endangerment showed a continuing danger of the children today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bentley, and thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is now submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within the time required by law. That concludes our oral arguments for today, so the court is now in recess.